meeting to open for petition.
May it please the court, I'm John McElhaney from Dallas, representing the petitioner Otis Engineering Corporation. I will make the opening argument for the petitioner, and Michael Moore of our law firm will make the rebuttal argument. The facts of the case are that Otis Engineering Corporation is a manufacturing company in Dallas that makes, among other things, oil well tools, drilling tools. They have a fairly large plant in Carrollton, Texas, northwest of Dallas, and they employ several shifts of workers in their manufacturing facility, including the driver of the automobile in question named Robert Matheson. Matheson was a machinist who worked on the second shift in July 1978. He worked on a grinding machine making parts in the Otis factory and had no outside duties as far as traveling for the employer on the employer's business. He the other factory workers there at that plant would drive his own vehicle to the company premises, park the company parking lot at the facility, and do his hourly work and punch in and out and then leave and go home on his own. The employer was not in any way involved in furnishing transportation or making arrangements for transportation for any of the employees. On July 11, 1978, Mr. Matheson, who was known to some fellow employees to imbibe by going out to his automobile on breaks and sneak some drinks in violation of company policy, was not performing very well on this evening shift that he was on. And some of the fellow employees called this fact to the attention of the supervisors. The immediate line supervisor of Mr. Matheson was Mr. Roy. Mr. Roy went and talked with Matheson, and the Roy deposition, of course, is in the summary judgment record here before the court. Mr. Roy went and talked with Mr. Matheson. Matheson at that time did not accept criticism of his work, was somewhat quarrelsome, and obviously was not functioning as he should be on this occasion. Mr. Roy suspected but did not know for sure that Matheson had been drinking on this particular evening. They call it lunch break, which actually, of course, is a dinner break, came up at about 8:45 p.m. It was a half-hour dinner break. Roy's conversation with Matheson about his problems that evening occurred before the dinner break. Then the 30-minute dinner break occurred. Matheson was not seen during this period of time. Apparently, went to his car as was on was his occasion as he had done on other occasions, and came back after dinner in a better frame of mind. However, did not seem to be functioning well enough that Otis wanted him to remain. Roy asked Matheson if Matheson would rather take the rest of the evening off. Roy did not directly order Matheson to leave, but it's undisputed from the summary judgment record that he had the power to do so, and that if Matheson would not have agreed voluntarily to leave, that Roy would have asked him to leave. Roy asked Matheson would he rather take the rest of the evening off, in his words. This is page 60 of the Roy deposition. And Matheson said yes, he would. Matheson then went to his machine, cleaned up the machine, and then on his way out of the plant stopped by Roy's office, and Roy walked with Matheson to the doorway. Respondents in summarizing the facts have engaged in a little hyperbole and overstated it somewhat. They have said, without any support in the record, that Roy walked on out to the car with Matheson. That the undisputed facts are that Roy stopped at the plant, but nevertheless did walk through the plant with Matheson on his way out, asked Matheson did he feel like he could make it and was everything all right, and Roy said, no, go home and get a good night's rest tomorrow. That was the last that Matheson was seen. About half an hour later. Matheson left the plant, by the way, at about 9:15 p.m. At 9:43 p.m., just about half an hour later, Matheson was involved in a fatal accident and had been operating his automobile at a high rate of speed, hit a bridge abutment. There was another road down below it. His car became airborne. He went off the bridge and landed on the other car, killing all of the occupants in a rather spectacular highway accident. As I say, this was about half an hour later. The scene of the accident was about 3 miles from the Otis plant. And so it's obvious that Matheson did something else during this half-hour period. Otherwise, you'd need to assume that he was driving at about 6 miles an hour during the entire time between he left and the time of the accident. And that doesn't seem like a logical inference. So it's obvious that Matheson did something else unknown to the parties during the intervening approximately one half hour. Now, the facts are undisputed, and Judge Joan Wynn, the trial judge, rendered summary judgment on an undisputed factual record that Matheson was not acting in the course and scope of his employment. He had definitely left his hourly employment at the Otis plant. There's no fact question about it, and we don't understand respondents to be contesting that. The court further rendered summary judgment, of course, because of the additional theories that the respondents do urge other than respondeat superior as a basis for liability. The other basis is the question as to whether the first person may be liable for failing to restrain or take charge of a second person who in turn injures a third person. And this whole area of the law is governed by several of the restatement of the torts sections, which I think bear some analysis here as they interrelate to each other. The theory that the respondents filed this suit on, the Clarks, who were the survivors of the victims of the traffic accident, was that Otis failed to restrain Matheson, preventing him from leaving its employment and going out on the highway and causing this traffic fatality. The restatement recognizes several principles, and the restatement sections are, of course, cited in our briefs here. But basically, to start with them in order, and in the order that the restatement deals with these concepts, Section 314 recognizes that there is no duty ordinarily to take charge of or to take action to prevent harm from someone, even though you realize that there's a likelihood that it'll happen, absent some other relationship. Section 314 provides that the fact that the actor realizes or should realize that action on his part is necessary for another's aid or protection does not itself impose upon him a duty to take such action. That's the basic common law starting point that we're all familiar with. The restatement then goes on and recognizes certain exceptions to this situation. One is where there is a special relationship between the actor and the person whom it's thought that there ought to be some control exercised over. In this situation, the only so-called special relationship that possibly applies is the master-servant relationship, but under the restatement dealing with that, there's no question that we are not liable, that Otis is not liable, because the master-servant relationship was over, the course and scope of the employment was over with for the evening, and there's no respondeat superior liability. And the restatement goes on then with Section 317, which bears closer analysis. Section 317 provides that an employer may be liable for the off-duty, off-premises torts of employees who are outside the course and scope of their employment in the general sense, if, and they give only two grounds here for such liability, only if the servant is on the premises of the master, or if the servant is using a chattel, such as an automobile, furnished to him by the employer. Neither of those conditions are met, and the evidence is undisputed that they are not. It's undisputed that Matheson was using his own automobile on a public highway, on a route selected by him. All of the ordinary tests of course and scope of employment in a workers' comp case, for instance, would clearly indicate that Matheson was not in the course and scope of his employment. And it's undisputed that the accident was off the premises of the employer. It's undisputed he was not using a chattel furnished by the employer. The Court of Appeals recognized this and cited this restatement section and recognized that no liability does attach under it. So that we don't understand respondents to be challenging that. The case then boils down to one, we believe, narrow thread that the liability is hoped to be predicated on, and that is Section 319 of the Restatement of Torts, Second. And it's our position that the Court of Appeals, in reversing and remanding for a trial, misapplied Section 319. Section 319 provides that one who takes charge of, and those are the operative words, takes charge of a third person whom he knows or should know to be likely to cause bodily harm to others, if not controlled, is under a duty to exercise reasonable care to prevent the harm. Now, this section of the restatement deals with custodial situations such as a jailer with dangerous inmates, or the managers of a mental hospital with dangerous inmates, who they have taken a custodial charge of for the protection of others, that is, for the protection of the public, to keep these dangerous individuals from being at large because it's likely that they will injure others. And they have assumed the active responsibility of this undertaking, and of course, are liable for their negligence if they fail to take follow through on this obligation that they've undertaken. Applied to the facts of an employer-employee relationship, this principle is in a posit in our judgment. It doesn't fit because employers just realistically don't hold their employees in a custodial relationship. The cases have recognized this, and common sense indicates it to any of us who have observed what happens in an ordinary employer-employee relationship. You don't surrender your civil rights to your employer merely by hiring on. The reality of it is that an employer has no legal right to detain employees as a mere incident to the employer-employee relationship. And although this may be a trite example, I think it illustrates my point, and that is, assuming that any of us had some dictation that we wanted our secretary to finish for the evening, secretary for some reason wanted to leave, we would not have a legal right to say, no, you are confined to this premises, you may not leave, your liberty will be restrained. We could go so far as to threaten to fire the employee. He said, if you leave, that's it, you're going to be fired. But that is as far as the law would recognize the right to detain an employee. Certainly you couldn't just clamp your secretary in irons without incurring liability for false imprisonment. The cases have recognized that this is a reason why employers are not liable for failing to control the conduct of a third party. I'd like to talk about some analogous situations that are cases that are cited in our brief that I think illustrate what I'm trying to say. The case of Sports Incorporated versus Gilbert, a 1982 Indiana appeals case that was decided, by the way, after the Court of Appeals ruled. So that court did not have the benefit of the holding in the Sports Incorporated case. It was a case where a drunk driver got on the parking lot of the defendant's speedway. He caused a minor traffic wreck right there on the Speedway premises. Peace officers that were off-duty, peace officers that were hired privately by the Speedway were on duty and apprehended the fellow. He got out of his car and ran, tried to hide in the weeds, and they found him, and they realized he was drunk. They put him back in his truck with a female companion, and they drove off and caused a traffic accident. Some obvious analogies to our situation. The Speedway was then sued by the victims, and the court held that the Speedway did not need to incur the risk of falsely imprisoning or a false imprisonment charge by grabbing onto this fella and detaining him and holding him. Even though they had hired off-duty policemen to be their guards at the parking lot, there wasn't any duty to make civil arrests and to detain people. And as a matter of law, there was no duty, therefore no liability. The Texas cases, of course, cited in our brief, recognize that employers don't have any immunity from false imprisonment claims. We think we have a situation that equally as strong as the law is in Indiana. Our brief does not cite the writ history of this Indiana case, but it has review has been denied by the Indiana Supreme Court, so the case as cited in our brief stands as the law of Indiana. Second case we'd like to call attention to is Massengale versus Yuma County, Arizona, cited in our brief. This is a case where a sheriff was on duty patrolling in his car. He observed the erratic driving of a drunk driver. He followed him along the highway for a while, but chose not to stop him and arrest him and take him into custody. This drunk driver then caused a bad traffic accident. Court's analysis, I think, is important because it recognizes that here is a peace officer who is employed and paid to apprehend people. That's what his specific job is, his duty. Nevertheless, his failure to perform that duty by apprehending and taking into custody does not lead to liability to each and every member of the public. There is, in the words of the court, no duty to each and every member of the public because such liability would be staggering. There may be a general duty to make arrests, but there is not liability that runs to members of the public who may become injured. Now, as applied to our case, there is even less reason to hold a private employer liable because we don't have peace officer authority to make civil arrests. We have certainly less duty to detain employees against their will or to undertake a duty to protect the world at large, as distinguished from a police officer whose duty you might say is to do that. Certainly, the duty of a private corporation does not extend to protection of the whole world by detaining its employees if in their judgment some particular employee for some reason on some night might not ought to be let off work. Next case is Harlan versus State, a California case cited in our brief. This recognizes the fact that it's a paternalistic and unrealistic duty to require one to take charge of another to keep him from driving on the highways. In this case, the offending driver was a resident of a state veterans home. He was physically impaired to the extent he required anticonvulsant drugs in order to control himself. He was let out of the veterans home on a pass and caused a fatal traffic accident. The court held that there was no cause of action on this theory because it was a paternalistic duty to require an unreasonably paternalistic duty to require the home to confine the veteran. And they recognized the situation that the threat of firing is not enough to create a duty. In this case, it wasn't a question of firing. It was a question of the way the home could enforce its will if they wanted to confine inmates to threatened to kick them out or to ask them to remove themselves from the home if they didn't obey. And the court recognizes that this is not a sufficient ground for imposing a duty to take charge of others. I think that's very analogous to the employer to control an employee who threatened to fire him, but comment B of Restatement Section 317 recognizes that the mere threat of firing is not a sufficient ground to control off-premises, off-duty employees. Finally, or rather next, I'd like to mention Bradshaw versus Rawlings, which I think is an important case, and I want to very briefly refer to some quotations in that case. This is a Third Circuit case decided in 1979. It involved a college in Pennsylvania that had an annual sophomore class picnic where they drank a lot of beer. And two college students went off the campus to the picnic, which was in effect sponsored by the college. And certainly the college had noticed that the beer would be served there. The flyers announcing the beer bust were prominently displayed around the campus, had been duplicated at the campus facility. The faculty sponsor had arranged for the payment of the beer, and there's no doubt that the college was on actual notice of the beer drinking and was on actual notice that minors would be there. The sophomores were underage for Pennsylvania law purposes to be drinking, and the college was therefore at least complicit in sponsoring the activity. One student takes another student to the beer bust, and they have a traffic accident coming back. The injured student says, "The college owed a duty to protect me and also owed a duty to control the driver, my fellow student driver of the car. I want to predicate liability on both of those relationships." They won more than $1 million verdict in the trial court. Third Circuit reversed with, I think, some very perceptive analysis of the duties and the relationships involved. The court recognizes and quotes from a torts textbook, Pollock on Torts, that negligence in the air, so to speak, will not do. The respondents can argue quite forcefully based on hindsight and based on the undisputed facts of the case that Otis did have some knowledge of Matheson's intoxicated condition, did have knowledge that he might be out there on the highway, or would be out there on the highway. That all this is negligence, and therefore there ought to be liability. As I understand it, that's essentially the main argument they make, that the negligence here is so obvious that the court must create a remedy. The problem is that they're putting the cart before the horse and talking about the facts that they would use to prove negligence, and they've skipped over the threshold requirement of legal duty. And that's where the restatement sections defining the duties and defining the relationships come into play, and that's where the Bradshaw versus Rawlings case, we believe, is perceptive and right on point. If I may be given the leave to indulge in a slight bit of reading, the court at page 141 holds, "Bradshaw's primary argument is that the college had knowledge that its students would drink beer at the picnic." Very much like respondents' argument that Otis had knowledge that Matheson had been drinking. Court goes on, "and that this conduct violated school regulation and state law." Well, certainly it was a violation of our company policy for Matheson to be drinking. "And that it created a known probability of harm to third persons." Again, analogous to what respondents said, "and that knowledge by the college of this probable harm imposed a duty to control the conduct." The court goes on, "the centerpiece of Bradshaw's argument is that beer drinking by undergraduate students in itself creates a special relationship on which to predicate liability. Since there was the opportunity of exercising control, there should be liability." The court holds, "these contentions miss the mark, however, because they blur the distinction between establishing of a duty and proving breach thereof. And the question here is a policy question. Should the courts impose a duty on employers to, in effect, incarcerate employees?" We say that this would be a drastic change in the relationship between an employer and an employee. If there's going to be a decision which leads to liability to incarcerated employees, there ought to be immunity for claims for false imprisonment. It ought to be clear that this is a duty that's been paternalistically imposed on employers for the protection of the entire world at large, and that employers have this duty. It will alter ordinary employee-employee relationships, because there are many other aspects to which this duty to control could be applied. For instance, if employees go home and beat their wives, if employees go out and sell drugs, if employees do anything else untoward or socially unacceptable outside of the course of their employment, what duties are we imposing on employers to either not employ the individual in the first place or to reach out and control their lives in a 1984 fashion? So that we don't think we're just crying wolf, this is an unwarranted and untoward attempt to expand the responsibility of employers. The rule would also remove individual responsibility to a great extent, or at least erode it, because if employees say, well, guys, employer is just supposed to take care of it and not let me go home if I've done something wrong, it's an erosion of individual responsibility. Finally, and very quickly, since the warning light is on, let me say that we don't believe that Section 319, the custodial charge section of the restatement that the respondents want to impose, is applicable here at all. Their complaint is not that we took charge of Matheson and then did wrong, but that we never took charge of him in the first place. That is, the respondents have charged that we failed to call the police, that we failed to call his wife, that we failed to provide a driver to take him home, that we failed to require that he go to the nurse's station, that we failed to, in effect, confine him to our premises. All these are clear indications that there was no custodial relationship ever undertaken by Otis. Therefore, there's no liability under Section 319, and this we urge was the error of the Court of Appeals in their opinion. Finally, I'd like to say that the respondent's attorney was kind enough to deliver to our hotel last night a copy of the summary of the argument that he has filed with the court. This does cite several new cases that hadn't been previously cited. Our own research done in the last 10 days to prepare for this argument on our Lexis machine has also indicated some new cases that have been published since our briefs were written. And if we may have permission within a time to be set by the court to file a very short reply that will address the new cases and also cite the new cases we found, we would greatly appreciate it.
How much time do you need, counsel?
Your Honor, if we could have no more than 10 days, we certainly would have it in by then.
It'll be granted and the respondent will be given an opportunity to reply. Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, I have one question.
Yes, sir.
I'm not clear on the facts as to whether or not the employee was sent home during his shift or was allowed to go home after the shift was completed.
Your Honor, the
facts to you?
I don't believe it does. The deposition of Mr. Roy addresses that, and he was asked the question both ways. And I think it's really a matter of semantics because he agreed to both sets of terms. The specific testimony of Mr. Roy on that point is at page 60 through 64. And the testimony was that he asked Matheson, wouldn't you rather go home? And Matheson said, yes. Roy then, on probing by the respondents, did say that if Matheson wouldn't have agreed voluntarily to go, that he would have asked him to go, and it was within his authority to relieve him of his job that night. There was testimony in other depositions, I believe Mr. Sartain, testified that particularly around Christmas time, there sometimes is more pervasive trouble with employees drinking on the job. It's a company rule that if you get caught drinking, you're going to get sent home. In this case, Mr. Roy has been willing not to make a distinction, so we do not make one ourselves.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. James Cronzer will present argument to the respondents.
I may have pleased the court, Mr. McElhaney, more. I think perhaps a good starting point for me would be the question that Judge Spirit posed, because it occurs to me that it's important to understand the context of the case to understand what it is you're being asked to decide. We're not here to decide whether some monstrous judgment should be affirmed. We're not here to determine whether the conduct of Otis Engineering was in fact neglectful. We're not here to ask you to determine as a matter of law whether something was a foreseeable cause or not a foreseeable cause. What we're here, and all we're here about, is to see whether in this summary judgment context there is a legal duty that permits a jury to assess fault. And that's what the question is. Now, when Mr. McElhaney stands before you and talks about the variances in the testimony of Mr. Roy and the other witnesses in this summary judgment context, that seems to me to be meaningless. He said he sent him home. He fell into the machine. His co-employees were complaining because he was a danger to them and to the equipment and to himself. The county medical examiner took a blood sample and he had a .268, which is the equivalency of 18 drinks in a two-hour period. They knew he not only did it on this day, but on previous occasions had remonstrated with him and affirmatively escorted him to the car and said, go home. Now, he didn't take a bullwhip to him. That's true. But they wanted him off the job. There's two types of liability we're talking about in one of these situations. The liability to the employee and his family itself. When you, in this case doesn't depend on drinking. If, while in your control and in your custody, an employee or a person becomes disabled for any cause. And incidentally, the employees here sought to make it appear that, well, he might not have been drunk. He had a lot of heart problems, too. He was cyanotic. His eyes were rolling in his head, according to these witnesses. He was falling and bobbing and weaving on the chair, as well he might. The county medical examiner said he's surprised he's able to sit in it. And they affirmatively, if this court please, cut him off in midship, gave him 30 minutes of lecture before the break. He went back out to that lot, knocked down some more vodka, came back in, and contrary to what Mr. McElhaney said, he was worse. They loaded him up and sent him home without sending him to the clinic. They had a clinic for this purpose. He wasn't resisting that. He was concerned they might be mad because of his being drunk and having to be sent home, and so expressed that fear. What they successfully did was to chop off their own liability for any risk they were running to him. And he says, expose the whole world. Let's look at that from a factual standpoint. Mr. Roy, after he sent him home, was talking to his supervisor, who had returned to the job, apparently. And he got to thinking after he heard of this accident. And he said, well, realizing that accident happened on the route that he would be taking going to his house, these are his words, I had a feeling it might be Matheson. So I went down to the police station myself. And I went in and I asked the desk sergeant, who was that involved in that wreck? And he said, a fellow said Matheson. Oh, my God. You know, going back to the legalities of this case, I mean, this is prescient foreseeability. This was releasing a squib on the public. Isn't there any doubt about it? And we're not asking that this court make a duty out of inaction or omission, but out of action, taking charge and doing something, an affirmative act. That's what we ask. In his argument, I think Mr. McElhaney pointed out the difference. I personally, as the court knows from the many years it's seen me here, hate to move with the short hops that the court sometimes has to do in terms of what changes it makes on a case-for-case basis. But the law of duty and the limitations upon duty historically are traced to Paul's Graffian-type limitations with respect to foreseeability, and on the other end, on the non-liability for omissions. We see that if you see somebody drowning or that you don't have a duty towards, you can just watch him drown. And the law said you have no obligations. I listened with great interest to a man I consider a great lawyer, Bill Meredith, when he was arguing the Sanchez case here 6 weeks ago, talking about foreseeability as a legal limitation. And that has been true if you talk about the effect of alcohol and extensions of liability from use of alcohol. The courts have not concerned themselves so much with the problem of whether alcohol would make somebody liable, whether they should be liable, but the dangers to where are we going to stop? You know, where would be the cutoff point if we just start imposing it? So they have just sort of a backdrop. That's foreseeable. You just can't go beyond that. It doesn't have anything to do with what you can foresee. As I say here, Mr. Roy had absolute factual foreseeability.
Counsel, let us suppose that this man had been drinking in a bar, had had just as much liquor, and the bar tender said, I'm not going to give you any more. We'll take you and put you in your car. What's your view of the dram shop cases?
Well, Your Honor, I guess I'll answer that in one of my usual obfuscations. This court doesn't have to go that far. The most recent case dealing with that very question.
But the area you're talking about is how far the court.
Well, let me answer it by giving you the most recent case. This case is a Colorado case decided last year, cited in our briefs. The fellow is drunker than Cooter Brown, and he comes to a bar. And he goes in there and they say, we ain't going to serve you. You're just too drunk, pal. And he said, well, somebody in here give me a start of my car. My battery's dead. And they said, no, we're not going to do that. So he gets somebody to help him give a kicker start or something. And he goes out and gets it started, and hooks him down the road and comes to another bar. Goes in and that guy also refuses service to him. But he asked for the privilege to be permitted to start it. And he sends one of his employees out, the barkeep, the bar owner. And they go out and start up his car, knowing he's drunkard, as I say, and he's obviously just weaving like this guy. And he just gets a couple of miles down the road and wham them. Now, the Colorado court reversed for trial purposes. I don't say the jury would have found that negligent, what the bartender did. A good Samaritan thing, but said he had taken charge and committed an affirmative act by helping that drunk get out to do destruction. Now, what I'm, Justice Pope, I'm not suggesting this case does not have to go that far because we have an underlying relationship with prior knowledge, mid-shift termination, and a lot of other things we think makes it different. Let me illustrate further, if I may, on your line. As much as I would hate to see this court draw these kind of proscriptions, if you take the history of duty, that is, the problems of duty, if Roy sat there and watched him stagger around all night until his 11 o'clock shift, and just, you know, he finally somehow was able to finish up and get out and go in and get in his car and hook him off, and he didn't do a thing, and just let him go on down the road and by force of circumstances, hit somebody, the same people, let's say just by a change of time. I'm not suggesting to you that the kind of distinctions in these cases, the kind we rely on as against kind, they don't permit that kind of a distinction. I would personally beseech the court not to ride that low road of distinctions, but because there's no action, there's no affirmation, there's no helping the guy drowning in the water in that situation. You see, Section 319 comes from this court's decision in Katie versus Wood. The language in all is traceable back to this court's decision a long time ago. But Katie versus Wood was the case in which for 25 cents a month, railroad employees paid for their privilege to get medical care from their employer. The court will recall in this record, they provided nursing stations, which was available to put this man in that night if they had chosen that option. He wasn't resisting that. In this case, here. So the smallpox epidemic was prevalent at that time, and so they didn't know what the guy had, so they sent him to Kansas City and where he contracted. They sent him back to around Waco, and they rented or Greenville, I guess it was, and they rented some kind of field and put him out there, and he became delirious, one of his employees of the railroad. The doctors had a person not trained to watch him, and he got up from his bed of delirium, walked 3 or 4 miles down the road, and walked up and contaminated somebody, the plaintiff, Woods, a third party, not related to the railroad. And this court held that having taken charge under their medical care there as an employee, trying to treat a smallpox, not to use care, that is the affirmative action, exposed it to liability to the third party. Now let's also look at his case that he talks about the cop not wanting to arrest the drunk, just sit there cleaning his fingernails while the drunk passes by. Again, that same metaphysical distinction between omission and act that's involved in Section 319 and 320 of the restatement is used there. The Court of Appeals in New York, in a Harvey case that we cited in our last effort, had a situation where a couple of cops picked up a couple of drunks, affirmative. And they took them to a place, instead of taking them down to the jail, which was too loud and too crowded, and a lot of problems, they were young drunks apparently, they took them to a field they had somewhere around New York, and just dumped them out a long way from town, so they'd sober up out in the field. Well, these fellas just decided they weren't going to stay out in the field, we're going to look for another talk. And they were about 350 yards from the freeway, or thruway, I guess they call it up there. So they staggered out onto the freeway to hook a ride, but they were so drunk, they got out in front of a car. And one got killed and the other got injured. Now the action, as distinguished from passing by the drunks, or picking up the drunks, that action alone, separated, that's reaching to help the drowning person, as distinguished from not. And that, in the Court of Appeals, just recently held that action was a 319-320. Now, those kind of cases, go well beyond, we submit, what's necessary here. There was available to this employer methods, at least for a jury to resolve, to have saved this tragedy to his family too. He was killed. And it seems to me, or it occurs to us more accurately, that it is not a satisfactory answer to say duty is discharged when we can get him off our premises and relieve ourselves of risk to our own people and to him on the premises, and the world take the hindmost. Now, if that's what duty means, when you have taken charge of him, you have provided care for the very person. Let's forget drinking. Let's say he did have heart ailments, angina, some other problem that was producing in him the same kind of incapacity that evening. And they sent him out the same way. He was falling around, weaving around. We wouldn't be talking about drama shop, but we'd be talking about what should the duty be, if any. Now, as we just respectfully submit to the court, these are red herrings to say we're trying to expand and make some judicial dram shop act. What we are saying is that when there is, in the relationship that they had between themselves, an opportunity to have prevented this occurrence, knowledge, toleration of it going on, affirmative conduct with respect to it, that you can't just, as in a wrestling match, gouge your eyes out and say to the referee, I didn't do anything.
Counsel, I'm not arguing with you. I'm just trying to find out where we're going. Let us assume that this drinking party had taken place, that there had been a drinking party at the home of this plaintiff. And he and his companions drank and drank and drank. And finally he says, now you all go home. And on the way home, one of the men that was drinking with him at his own home has an accident. Now, does that widow have a cause of action against a person who drinks to excess in a home?
Are you talking about a private, non-business related?
Yes.
Your Honor, there again, I must say candidly, the courts make a distinction between a business related, a party for Christmas parties. There are cases in this variety, and where if you succeed in getting a person drunk at your Christmas party and you don't do anything to help them or hinder them in either in getting drunk or sending them home, you don't have under current law any exposure into the private sector, as I understand the law. If you're talking though about somebody that you're engaged in making business with and you're cutting him off in the middle of his shift, taking action in your own employee that you're making to work in that deal, and they're getting drunk, and you're cutting them off, and you're letting them get that drunk, you're talking about a different thing. It's unfortunately action versus inaction and business related against non-business related. I can understand the reluctance to extend liability, as we have made in Texas historically, between the business invitee and the invitee in your home. And it's the same thing in terms of that.
In this particular case here, what you're urging that Roy should have done is send it to the sick bay.
I'd say, Judge, he had a multiple of alternatives. In Baker versus Adkins, the subsequent case, a civil case, it's true, by the San Antonio court, based upon Wood, in which they did not have the facility, as in Wood, discuss the alternative of his wife or transporting him to a safer place or getting him to a clinic or getting him to a better facility, and didn't even try to multiply the alternatives. But
assume for the sake of argument, trying to see the rule that you're...
I'm not talking...
For the sake of argument, they say, look, you got to go to sick bay and lie down. You're too drunk to even drive home. And suppose in that situation he refused to go. Is the key to yours to have control over him?
No.
Make him go? Or?
My belief is this. For example, there are other cases that you'll see cited in this last brief, where a doctor fails to tell his patient you ought not to drive when you're using these pills because they will cause some epileptiform seizure. He gets out in the car, does it, hurts somebody, and hurts a third party. They've held the third party can recover against the doctor, even though he didn't know anything about it. And the same thing is true here. Is in the instance of, it's not a matter of physical custodial incarcerative control. It's what possible remedies that are rational and reasonable did Otis have with their knowledge and with what they were doing with it, that they could have utilized. And what do I say they did have? They had the, because they had it provided for them, he wasn't resisting it. One of the witness Sartain said that's exactly what the clinic was for when people were sick or ill, to put them in. That's what they were provided for. I don't say that if
I'm
he...
I'm trying to draw some perimeters. You say
I'm saying that if he says, no, I ain't going there. I'm going to go out and get in my car.
You wouldn't extend it to a party at your home. And one reason you wouldn't extend it is that you might advise somebody to take care of the home.
Not so long as it was a private...
If they decide to go, they're going to go.
Not so long as it's a private party. My estate's not large enough to cover some of the people I've sent home.
Three people down there riding, meeting them head on. It doesn't matter what they come from.
That's correct. I'm saying that distinction in the cases is made between business and social. But I'm adding to this, Judge, that the phoning or having one of the co-employees, they knew which way his home was. In this instance, the foreman, to take him home, to help him home. He said, you're not mad at me, or to get a co-employee, to phone his wife. Sure, that's a problem, but she's bound to have known his problems too. But to have exposed him to this risk, to have phoned the police to come take him home, but not to have just saved their own company and put him out on the road. That is the question. Can they do that, get him shut out in their operation, and leave him to the world? That is the question, and as I see it, if they have reasonable alternatives that should be measurable by a fact finder to see is that reasonable to suggest they try to get him shut down there or try to take him home and have the jury assess that as a measurable way for care once they have taken charge. The jury's not required to determine that they wouldn't be acting reasonably. But that, for us, for the courts to put the crustacean of duty, you owe no duty to the public or to persons that can foreseeably be affected by that, when you're permitting, tolerating that on your premises, it seems to me it goes in direct contravention of everything we know about the protection against affirmative action. Once you leave the omission side of it, there are, I was sorry to be that delayed in the filing of this late brief. There is a recent case from Supreme Court of Alabama and Georgia just affirmed last Wednesday, and I didn't even have the opinion until yesterday afternoon. It was mailed here, and I will just file the opinion with the clerk, give Mr. McElhaney a copy, dealing with these having to do with a private, it's another one of the sanitarium cases where the neuropsychiatrist let a fellow go on a weekend pass, and they cite all these type cases. But it seems to me that gets to it, Judge Barrow, is it a question when you know, and you don't just know it that day, you just didn't learn it that moment. It's been a continuing thing. And he is in such bad condition that you have terminated him, taken him out, and believe me, when you look at the record, if you haven't already done the fact record, sent him home, did not suggest he do any of these things, just get him out of here. And it, with obvious knowledge of the risk it was exposing to the public, and if there isn't some prescribed liability for that affirmative conduct, I suggest that duty has become restrictive rather than at least meeting the needs of this type of a situation. I don't think it has anything to do with alcoholism. I think it has to do with care of those that are dangerously ill. And that's what Section 319 is talking about, those that are physically incapable of taking care of themselves. And that is what I believe the type of extension of liability that we're talking about here is. And I suggest that it doesn't have to involve incarceration, imprisonment, or anything else to form a basis for liability, or at least to have a jury pass upon the reasonableness of their conduct when they turned him loose that night with no suggestion of any help of any kind. Thank you very much.
Counsel, we'll hear a reply from the petitioner.
May it please the court, Mr. Michael Moore will present argument for the petitioner.
May it please the court. The question here is a question of law. Under Texas law, the determination of the parameters of legal duty is a legal question. It is a threshold issue that must be determined prior to any consideration of negligence, what opportunities were available, or foreseeability, which has been discussed by the respondents. The reference to Paul's graph and foreseabilities is another element of a negligence case, which is not even reached until the issue of duty, the legal issue, is reached. The reliance on Wood versus MKT is misplaced. In that case, the railroad undertook a duty to take charge of employees, put them in quarantine, and once that undertaking was made, then had an obligation to exercise reasonable care. Furthermore, a reading of the facts of that case indicate how different it is from the type of situation that faces this court. If I may briefly just read from that opinion, the object of placing Dixon, that was the fellow with smallpox, in the tent and supplying a nurse and a guard for him was not alone to care for and to provide for him, but was to protect the public against infection by contact. In Wood, the railroad undertook to protect the public at large from this employee. We would submit that this case, Otis Engineering case, there is no such undertaking. Section 319 is simply inapplicable. Otis Engineering never took charge of Mr. Matheson so as to give rise to the kind of duty which is found in the Wood case, in the types of cases like Wood, which usually involve insane asylums and prisons. The brief that was recently filed in this case by the respondent cites the recent Georgia case, Bradley Center, Inc. v. Wessner. The court in that case found control and take charge of under Section 319. It was a private mental health hospital that was held liable for the murder of the plaintiff's mother by the plaintiff's father. The father had been in the mental institution for 4 months. In fact, the day prior to the pass that he received to go home for the weekend, the doctor's notes indicated that he had threatened to kill the mother. And the doctor's note said, we should avoid allowing this patient to have any contact with his wife. The control facts that the court found to trigger Section 319 tort duty were significant and highly different from the type of case we have in the ordinary employer-employee relationship in the state of Texas. Here are those facts in the case that the respondents are relying on. A patient in the insane asylum requesting a discharge against medical advice can be detained for 48 hours so he can confer with his relatives to get him to stay in confinement. There were actual physical locks for disturbed patients to accomplish escape prevention to prevent an unwell patient from leaving the confines of the mental hospital. In other words, that was a case that triggered and fell into Section 319, which is completely inapplicable to this case. The court held in the recent Georgia case that is all points of custody and take charge of. It seems clear that the appellant had taken charge of Mr. Wessner and that he was under the control of the appellant throughout his second admission and specifically on the day of the murder. So those are cases in which there is this element of custody, and they even have been applied in situations where a prison negligently allows a inmate to escape.
Counselor, would you make the distinction in this case between had they taken the sick bay, clinic, whatever they call the place, and told the nurse, keep him here a couple of hours and then sober up. She let him get out, and just as the adverse attorney has suggested, they just wanted him off their premises and taking his car. Would that be the distinction you're arguing now?
Your Honor, that's precisely the distinction I'm making. Had Otis done anything to take charge of, to put him into custody, then perhaps a duty to exercise reasonable care would have occurred.
In other words, you're saying imperfectly trying to prevent him harming somebody but exposing the liability, but not caring about exposing him to harm, letting him harm other people in their free. Is that about right?
Your Honor, this is unlike the Wood case where there was an undertaking to protect the public.
Well, I think that's your distinction. In this case, Otis says we're going to try to keep him here and throw him up because he can be dangerous if he gets on the highway. They do it imperfectly. They're exposed to liability. If they just don't care, all they want is to get him out of their hair, then there's no liability. Is that the distinction you're making?
Your Honor, I'm not sure that's precisely the distinction we're making. We are saying that this is not a take charge of case under Section 319, and that the cases that are cited and relied on by the respondents are situations where there is the custodial relationship between the parties that gives rise to that duty. Wood is a case like that where the railroad undertook to protect the public in general from their employee. There was no such undertaking in this case. This case is governed, we believe, by Section 317. And the policy parameters that go into Section 317 is that when the employee is not in the course and scope, the employer is only liable only has a duty if the misconduct occurs on the premises, the accident occurs on the premises, or if he's using a chattel or instrumentality. The active-passive distinction, I think Mr. Kronzer expressed it correctly, is metaphysical. It has nothing to do with the policy matters which are presented in this case. Let's take, for example, the dram shop line of cases that have developed throughout the country. There is virtually no jurisdiction in the United States which would impose duty to restrain a third person on a social host. Now, is that a situation where it's affirmative or passive or whatever? If you're a social host, oftentimes the social host is providing, or usually is by definition, he's actively providing liquor to a guest. Oftentimes is the case, probably pushing drinks on a guest. Let's say the guest becomes unruly in the social and starts to knock over a lamp or whatever, and the host says, please leave my home. I don't want you in my home anymore. Well, is that an affirmative action sending him out? It's a metaphysical distinction. The courts have held across the board that there is no liability in that situation, in that there is no duty to control the third person so as to prevent harm to others. And that's even a stronger case than the one we have here, where we provided no alcohol, we took no affirmative steps, as would be the situation in that case. In fact, the Shasteen versus Litton case, which is cited in our brief, is the type of case that involves a company Christmas party. There, the employer, Litton Industries, had a Christmas party sponsored, much like the Bradshaw case, sponsored on its premises, provided alcohol to employees. An employee leaves the premises, has a wreck, the court finds that there is no duty to control that employee once
he leaves. Was there evidence that they knew he was drunk when he left in that Litton case?
Your Honor, I believe that there was. I believe that the evidence was that the employee was intoxicated. A case that I can cite, Your Honor, where I'm clearly recollect that there was the Calro case out of California. In that case, the off-duty employee was on the premises. Big Mike was his name. He was drinking large quantities of beer and wine. And the supervisor knew he was intoxicated and did not want him on the premises and told him to leave the premises. He had an accident. The California courts found no duty. Now, the California courts have gone farther than any courts anywhere in finding duties in these kind of cases, but even the California courts in Calro would not extend it that far. Another distinction, which I believe is metaphysical, to use Mr. Kronzer's words, not really applicable to the decision that's to be made here, is this decision between business and social. That is not a distinction of the dram shop line of cases. The Shasteen versus Litton case, that was in a business context. The Calro case out of California, that was in a business context. So those distinctions, active, passive, business, social, are not distinctions. The issue here is whether or not the employer in Texas has the duty to restrain the individual employee from leaving the premises, and most importantly, whether or not a duty arises to each and every member of the public, even in the cases involving psychotherapists. There's a case in California that's been widely cited, the Tarasoff decision. Even in those cases where a psychotherapist has a patient who has dangerous propensities, which he knows he is a dangerous patient, the courts have limited liability to readily identifiable victims. In other words, the court has not found liability unless the patient says, I'm going to go out and kill so-and-so. If they just have knowledge of dangerous propensities in general, the court will not find a duty in that case.
Counsel, do you see a distinction between refusing to prevent a drunken employee from leaving and sending a drunken employee out on the road?
Your Honor, I believe that gets back to the active-passive distinction, and we strongly feel that is not a difference in this case. And I go back to the Dram Shop cases. If you have a party in your home and you send somebody home, use those words, send them home, rather than just fail to restrain them as they're walking out the door unknown to you, that has made no difference whatsoever in the analysis that's been used in those cases, which is the same analysis we submit that should be used in these cases. We strongly feel that is not a distinction, does not grapple with the policy issues that are wrapped up into this whole question of duty, which must be reached before the issues of negligence and proximate cause are reached. I'm running out of time. Just in summation, we would respectfully submit that this case, if Court of Civil Appeals is affirmed in their expansion of tort liability in Texas, significantly opens up numerous areas of expanded tort liability in Texas related to restraining intoxicated persons. This is an area, as we've cited cases in our brief, where courts across the country have decided, and we believe wisely so, to defer to the legislature, to let the legislative process, with the input that comes in from all various sources of the community, to decide these issues. And we feel that the decision of the Court of Civil Appeals should be reversed and the trial court should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for petitioner has asked for 10 days to answer the brief and has also stated that he has run on to some additional citations. Counsel, how much time would you like to reply?
Not more than 5 days.
All right, 10 days to the petitioner and 5 days to answer by the respondent. Thank you, counsel. The court will take a 10-minute recess.
Please rise.
The middle section.